this worship series on the evolution of God is unfolding, or should I say evolving, differently than I had imagined. At first, I thought it would be 4 or 5 sermons, which became 6, now 7. I think 7 is going to be it, but we'll see. Turns out God is a big story to tell. Last week, we considered what is known, or rather speculated, about the spiritual landscape of the earliest known humans, hunter-gatherer societies. Of course, there can be no detailed account of whatever it is they thought or believed, because there was no writing when they lived, no way to record it. We do know that primal religions were polytheistic. They incorporated the presence of multiple spirits or gods or supernatural beings. And today's sermon was to have been about the move from polytheism to monotheism. And in a way, it is about moving toward one God with a capital G instead of lots of gods. However, there's a very important way station in that transition, one that upon further consideration deserved a sermon of its own. Because after polytheism came monolatry. I know what you're thinking, what is monolatry? That's what I thought when I first heard the word. Monolatry is the worship of one God without denying the existence of many gods. Lots of gods with one on top. I tell you right now, monolatry is not recognized by spell check as a word, but I promise you it is one. And I've included in your bulletin a little sermon outline if that's helpful to you. And a significant portion of the Hebrew Scriptures, an important stage in the development of our faith, was spent in monolatry. Our ancestors worshipped many gods on their way to proclaiming Yahweh as the one true God. Now, when we study history, we learn about ourselves. As far as the history of the God of Christianity goes, it is a story of change. Contrary to popular belief, Christianity did not drop out of the sky in some pure form, nor did the Judaism from which Christianity was born. At every stage, our tradition was shaped by things like politics and economics, as well as theology, changes that continue to this day. So if we're better educated about the changing nature of our own faith, maybe it will be easier to embrace the changes that we're seeing today. Christianity, like most religions, continues to evolve. Over time, these evolutions move us forward. I believe that's true, although we have to have an eye for the long run, for sure. And I hope that if we better understand the development of our faith, then we will come to see it as even more relevant and real and dynamic. And sometimes we read the Bible and it resonates deeply with us. And then sometimes we read the stories and it just seems very removed from who we are. It's as we look closer and we seek to understand on a deeper level that ancient biblical stories come alive. We get to know biblical characters with whom we can identify, maybe even resonate. And we see we're not as removed from them as we thought we were. So, let's talk about Jezebel. When I say the name Jezebel, what comes to mind? Well, I'll tell you. Jezebel was the wife of King Ahab. And in the pages of the Bible, let's just say that Jezebel does not come off well. Not many parents name their cute little baby girls Jezebel. Has anyone ever known an actual person named Jezebel? Me neither. I'd like to, actually. Lots of Rebeccas, lots of Sarahs, a million Marys, but few Jezebels. I guess that's because, according to the good people at Merriam-Webster, the slang definition of Jezebel is an impudent, shameless, or morally unrestrained woman. The Jezebel of the Hebrew Scriptures came from Phoenicia. It's an ancient civilization that disappeared a couple of thousand years ago. So the first thing to remember about Jezebel is that she is a foreigner. She married King Ahab. She ruled with him. So she was Queen Jezebel. She was a powerful foreign woman, and none of those descriptors bode well for her. Things haven't changed a lot in that regard. Nevertheless, she persisted. When men of royalty, like Ahab, married foreign women, it wasn't usually because they fell in love. I mean, maybe they hit it off. Who knows? I hope they did. But marriages like that could be viewed as foreign policy, right? It was a way for one nation to make alliances with another. I mention it because there is an aspect of internationalism that will come into play in a little bit. So King Ahab, Jezebel's husband, worshipped Yahweh, and Jezebel, the foreigner, encouraged the worship of other deities, specifically the Canaanite god Baal. Jezebel was a key behind-the-scenes player in an episode that we're going to read in a moment, so you might grab a Bible. We're getting to that point. It's considered a milestone in the evolution of monolatry, the transition in which Yahweh evolved to a higher status among the presence of many gods. Jezebel was a key player, along with her husband, Ahab, and one more, the prophet Elijah. Just three figures to remember for the context of Scripture today. Elijah, of course, was the key advisor, a prophet, the key advisor to King Ahab. So let me set the stage for this story that we're going to read. Israel was in a drought. It hadn't rained in 3 years. There was widespread famine. Springs were disappearing. Animals were dying. People were starving. You get the idea. Elijah, the prophet, to King Ahab, gets a word from the Lord. He goes to Ahab and he tells him, Yahweh is not happy with you because you, through your wife Jezebel, have encouraged people to worship Baal instead of Yahweh. And Elijah tells Ahab, I've got an idea, I'm going to fix this, call everybody together. So we're going to pick up our reading there, grab a Bible and turn to 1 Kings chapter 18. Whoever finds it, let us know the page number. 325, 1 Kings. It's an extended passage, so it will help you follow if you're able to read along as Michelle reads for us. 1 Kings, of course, in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, as it's sometimes called. We're going to begin reading 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 20. You know, there's an expression, blank or get off the blank. Maybe you've heard it. That is essentially Elijah's tone. You know, make up your mind, Yahweh or Baal, and the people are silent. Cats got their tongues. They don't know what to say. Verse 22. He's referring to an earlier episode in which Jezebel had a lot of prophets who worshipped Yahweh. She had a whole bunch of them killed, leaving Elijah's side severely outnumbered. But Elijah is not one to be intimidated. He proposes a sort of Yahweh versus Baal showdown, a smackdown, if you will. Verse 23 will tell us the rules. So Elijah proposes a little test, a big test, to see whether Yahweh or Baal is the true God, and he gives Baal every advantage. On the one side are 450 prophets of Baal, and on the other, only Elijah, because Jezebel had all the rest killed. Each side will offer a bull as a sacrifice on the altar. Each side will invoke the name of its deity, and the deity who responds and lights the altar on fire is the winner, the true God. Verse 25. So things are not going well for Team Baal, obviously, and Elijah starts in with the taunts. It reminds me of during the Cowboys-Broncos game last week when Lisa's brother from Colorado kept texting me his comments about how terrible the Cowboys were playing. That was a bad game, but I digress. Though I was not happy with his text, his taunting text, I did not respond as Baal followers did. Verse 28. Baal does not come through. Now it's Elijah's turn. Verse 30. So Elijah gets the altar and the bull all ready, but then he is so confident that he doubles down, back to the middle of verse 33. Elijah, don't you think he has a flair for the dramatic? Yes. I've known guys like that. You probably have too. He's upping the ante. He's building suspense. He's going to ask Yahweh to ignite water-drenched wood, which seems kind of wasteful if you're in a drought, but okay. Verse 36. An oblation is an offering. Okay, tension is heightened, and I really wanted a drum roll. All right, verse 38. Sweet, thank you. Church, do we have special effects or what? The people are duly awed. They fall down in worship of Yahweh. One more verse to the end of the story, verse 40. Thank you, Michelle. The triumphal story ends, as these stories often do, in slaughter. When you proclaim one God above all others, it makes it a whole lot easier to wipe out anyone who doesn't agree with you. In this story, Baal and the other gods do not cease to exist, right? But Yahweh is established as the reigning deity, as the most powerful one. And so the stage is set. Full-fledged monotheism, worship of only Yahweh is on its way, and we're going to talk more about that next week. Now, did anything like this showdown between Yahweh and Baal actually happen? Well, like most of the Bible, we cannot be for sure. We don't know. You know, if it did, if there was some kernel of fact to it, the story would not have been written down until centuries after. And what we have in the Hebrew Scriptures was eventually edited by people who were themselves monotheistic, people who championed exclusive devotion to Yahweh. So presumably, even if there is a kernel of fact in the story, it was spun in the direction of monotheism. But I want to close by considering just a few of the dynamics at work in this chapter of the story of God and the overall culture of this stage in our history. First, note that the worship of Baal is explicitly linked to Jezebel. And the text takes great pains to identify Jezebel as a foreigner, earlier from what we read today. She's clearly identified as a foreigner. So flash forward a century or so after this story. By that time, Elijah is gone, Ahab, Jezebel are long gone, and Amos and Hosea are the prophets of influence now. During the era of their prophecies, we see two economic and political realities that are going to push us toward monotheism. First, among the Israelites, there is this widening economic gap between rich and poor. And among the poor, there's a growing resentment of Israel's upper class. And two, there is increasing opposition to foreign powers and their gods. It draws on this story of the foreigner Jezebel and her worship of Baal. Archaeological excavations show compelling evidence of this tremendous economic inequality during Hosea's era. The poor were getting poorer, the rich were getting richer, and international trade was on the rise. This comes through in our biblical story, but it also is supported outside of the Bible in archaeological evidence. And these two factors are linked because it was the elite who controlled foreign trade and who profited from it, right? Rich people own the pricey imports of the day. It sounds familiar, right? Some rich folks like to brandish exotic imports, and even today might get resented for it. But in ancient Israel, it wasn't about Maseratis or Ferraris so much as it was about exotic fabrics or spices, or jewels. The poor people didn't have the foreign imports, and they resented the rich who did. And so as we move toward monotheism, which we'll continue to talk about next week, I just want you to keep in mind a few observations. The move toward monolatry, and later monotheism, was fueled in part by populist nationalism. The people were energized by the common man's resentment of cosmopolitan elites who were perceived to be in cahoots with foreigners. And as the story of our faith unfolds, as our God evolves, we see that Yahweh will move to the center and become the national God of Israel. And we see foreign influence in the form of foreign gods characterized as increasingly sinister. Now, then and now, if you can manage to connect a religious tradition to the alien, right, to the foreigner, and project the foreigner as evil, then the inevitable result is a rally around the flag effect. Because when a nation faces a crisis, whether it's outburst of war or a shocking terrorist attack, support for the nation's leader grows. And Israel was in a permanent state of crisis. In times of national crisis, the political leadership's popularity grows, and people are more willing to cede power to it. And for leaders who seek to amass more power, a category that includes roughly every king who has ever lived, maybe some presidents too, a foreign threat is an opportunity It's a magic moment to be seized. Next week, we're going to learn about Josiah, the Israelite king who seized that moment in ancient Israel. And we'll see that along with monotheism came religious intolerance. If there is only one God, then the next step is to obliterate all the rest. And the link between monotheism and religious intolerance, it's a pretty pertinent issue, isn't it? It's a dilemma that we Christians who call ourselves progressive have to figure out. We continue to struggle with it. It's complicated to hold the particularity of our faith as sacred and at the same time to allow others to do the same. I don't have all of the answers for that. I hate to break it to you. But we'll keep talking about it next week. I know that we can learn a lot from the story of our evolving God.